next a few minutes on Fresh Air. In about 20 minutes, my guest will be Marilyn Bedell, who has written a new biography of the Alcott family. So she'll be with us in just a few minutes. Right now, my guest is country comedian and star of the Grand Ole Opry, Minnie Pearl. In 1975, when she was awarded the Country Music Hall of Fame Award, she received a plaque which had this inscribed on it: "Humor is the least recorded, but certainly one of the most important aspects of live country music. No one exemplifies the endearing values of pure country comedy more than Minnie Pearl." Born Sarah Ophelia Colley in Centerville, Tennessee, educated at fashionable Ward Bellman College, joined the Grand Ole Opry in 1940. Her trademark, the dime store hat with the dangling price tag and shrill "Howdy, I'm just so proud to be here," made her first country music humorist to be known and loved worldwide. Minnie Pearl has written her autobiography, and it's called Minnie Pearl, An Autobiography. Welcome to Fresh Air, Minnie Pearl. Great pleasure to meet you.
Thank you very much, Terry. It's very kind of you to let me come on.
Some people who have become known as comedians, and I'm thinking particularly of Anna Russell here, got their start trying to be very serious about, you know, singing, for instance, and found that people laughed at them, whether they meant to be funny or not, and that helped channel them into comedy. Did anything like that ever happen to you, where you were trying to really be serious but found that people were laughing?
Well, yes, I had that happen several times in my early life. I think probably what happened in my case was that I was unaware at the time I was growing up, I was unaware of the fact that God has given some people the talent or the quality of being a clown, or rather being funny, being able to make people laugh. And it's a very rare quality, and one that people should be handle very carefully and should be very proud of, which I was not aware of at that point. I thought at the point that I was growing up, and I would either consciously or unconsciously get a laugh, whether I intended to or not, I had the feeling that I didn't want them to laugh at me. You know, I wanted to be serious, and I wanted to be an actress. I knew I was destined for show business, but I didn't know in what capacity, because whereas most little children in my hometown, who my age, spoke of stage fright and spoke of being timid, not wanting to go on stage and not wanting to stand up in public and talk, I always had the feeling that I could do it, and it never bothered me. And it was only after I got into the business that I realized that stage fright is not, after all, just stage fright. It's apprehension, hoping that you'll do well, and the obligation you have toward people who are paying you and people who are in the business with you and people who are friends and family and so forth. But I was not aware of this gift. I didn't know what a gift it was. And I wanted to be a serious actress. And it is, the book is about the transition from this little funny-looking skinny gal with freckles and a Dutch bob where the bangs were always coming down her eyes because Mama had five little girls and she couldn't get us all to the woman who cut our hair regularly. But the book is made up of this transition from this little girl who didn't realize she had this quality to the point in my life where I realized that comedy was my goal.
Your stage persona is a very loud, brash, raucous persona. Now, what was the image of femininity and girlhood like when you were growing up? Because I'm sure it wasn't being on stage screaming,
"Howdy." Oh, no, it was. Problem of women not wanting to be funny and wanting to be a sex appeal object has kept a lot of real cute women from going into comedy. I've run into them from time to time since I've been in this business. And they come to me after I've worked backstage, and they say, "I always wanted to do something like that, but I just never could bring myself to do it." Well, as you say, this strong image of a woman being a lady, particularly in the South where I came from, being demure and sitting quietly in a corner or sitting anywhere, not being noticed other than the fact that she was beautiful and well-behaved and had lovely manners, beautifully dressed and all that sort of thing. That was the image of a femininity that a woman didn't want to dispel by being funny. And it just wasn't good taste to make yourself an object of ridicule. And I grew up in that era, and Mama used to tell me to behave. Mama used to tell me to hush. Mama used to tell me to behave and be a lady. And Daddy said I talked too loud and walked too heavy and laughed too much and all that sort of thing. And they tried every way in the world and even sent me to a very beautiful girls' boarding school, which was a very fine finishing school at that point, Ward Belmont, which no longer exists. It was in Nashville, Tennessee.
There's a great photograph in your book of you when you were in Ward Belmont wearing this elaborately frilled dress.
Oh, yes. Ward Belmont in the 30s, when I went there, was comparable to, the finishing school, per se, at that point was such a restricted, almost a convent-type atmosphere. And we were supposed to learn at Ward Belmont, perfect our table manners, perfect our drawing room manners, and perfect our wardrobe, perfect our, particularly our speaking voices. And it's pretty funny now to think that that Minnie Pearl evolved out of that atmosphere. I wasn't supposed to be at Ward Belmont. We had lost our money in the Depression. My father was a lumberman, and they offered me, my family, my dad had sent four older girls to schools and given them an education. And when I came along 7 years after my next sister, they, when it got time for me to go to college, Daddy, as I said, had lost his money. And we really didn't have money to send me anywhere, but Mom and Daddy stretched and said they'd send me either 4 years to the state university or 2 years to Ward Belmont. Well, all my life I had heard about the dramatic department at Ward Belmont, and so I opted for the 2 years at Ward Belmont. Ward Belmont now has been bought by has been bought by the Baptist Church in Nashville, and they have enlarged it, and it's coeducational, and very little is left of the atmosphere and ambience. And the picture of the old school as it was built around an Ackland mansion, which was the home of a very, very wealthy family there, and had a beautiful series of receiving rooms in the mansion, which was what we called Rec Hall. It was Recreation Hall. Of course, we shortened it to Rec Hall. But when I hit there, I was not prepared for what I was getting into, and I still had this irrepressible sense of humor, which the Lord was trying to tell me I should use because it was so great. But I couldn't see it. And I cried the first whole month because I felt that I was out of place and I felt that nobody thought I was funny or cute or anything else, which I try to bring out in the book is sometimes stupid thing that people do unconsciously, of course, but people don't like people who are sad. You know, I mean, they're that is, who remain sad. I mean, you know, they're not drawn to them.
Well, the Minnie Pearl persona was obviously not what the finishing school you went to had in mind when they were trying to shape you. But from where in your life and from where in what you'd seen did you create Minnie Pearl?
Well, when I went back home, I had I wanted to go on to the American Academy after I finished Ward Belmont. There was a metamorphosis which took place at Ward Belmont, though. After I'd been so sad and homesick and had thought I was in the wrong place, I, through a series of events which I brought out in the book, I was able to get myself together and became a fun-type person to be with on the campus. And I loved campus life. I loved dormitory life. And I ended up being, immodestly speaking, rather popular on the campus. Then I went home and taught for 2 years. And then I went on the road with a producing company out of Atlanta, putting on amateur plays, still not admitting the fact that comedy was my way to go. And
what were you trying for at that time? Acting? Singing?
Producing. I was directing at that point. And acting, yes. I thought I'd still go on and be an actress. Because, see, I was only 21 when I left home to go with this producing company, and I thought by the time I was 30, I would be out of this producing company into Broadway. I just knew my name would be on Broadway in lights. And I had such indestructible dreams, I thought. You know, I mean, I had some setbacks by not being able to go on to a dramatic school, but I thought I was going to be able to really achieve this dream. And then I ran into this funny old woman while I was putting on a play in northern Alabama with a consolidated school there, and I had to stay in a mountain cabin. It sounds fabricated, because nowadays this would never happen. But at that point, there were these consolidated schools where they brought the children in the big yellow buses, and that's where we put on our plays. And it was something, as I said, it's hard for people nowadays to realize that this existed, this profession. The man I worked with had 150 coaches going out all over the Southeast. And it was a very unusual experience that I had up there. And I was so impressed by this woman, old woman, that was a country, she was a country, a humorous country woman. And I came away imitating her and talking like her, just for fun. I always imitated people. And before I realized it, I had more or less created a character that people would laugh at. I'd just say, I was up in northern Alabama putting on a play, and I met this old woman, and she said, and then I'd go into this act, not knowing it was an act, but, I mean, I'd start telling these stories. And the first thing you knew, I was collecting country stories, collecting country music, and I became, from having been from the country and then been in this other atmosphere, I found myself retreating and regressing back into the country atmosphere that I loved when I was at home. And then I named this character, and named her Minnie Pearl, because I thought they were two wonderful country names. And then I got the audition at WSM. It's a long process, really. And it's, as I said, it's brought out the book, and I hope that it's brought out in such a way that it's fun. And the crises that developed were not all that lengthy, because I came out of them. And what I tried to bring out most of all in the book is that those things that seem so hard at the time, if we just keep the faith, we'll come through them. And that's the way I feel about my life.
I bet you saw a lot of people, though, who had pretty tragic ends.
I did. And I have since I've been in this business. Show business is not, I don't think it's any different from a lot of the other professions. There's some survive and some who don't. It takes an awful lot of stamina. It takes an awful lot of an awful lot of humor. It takes a great sense of humor to survive in this life.
I'm sorry.
I'm all right. What'd you say?
How do you think television has affected country performance, singing, and comedy?
Oh, well, it's just been our salvation, and all of us. It's given the record sellers more exposure, and it's given our comedy more exposure, and it's just been the lifeblood of our business. And I believe, though, Terry, that Minnie Pearl's, I speak of her in the third person because she is different from me. I think her salvation has been the fact that so many, many people remember her from the radio days. See, I was on for 20 long, happy years every Saturday night on the Grand Ole Opry on the NBC portion of the Prince Albert Tobacco Company show. And if you have a program that you listen to regularly, like your listeners listen to this, it's the same time every afternoon, or it's the same time every week, and people sort of gear their lives to that, you know, and it becomes a sort of a part. It's sort of like a diary. It becomes a part of their day. Or part of the week. And that's the way our show was. And now, I've been on tour with this promotion now with Simon and Schuster for this book. This is the fourth day. We started Monday. And I have changed towns every day and have had numerous interviews and talk shows where the people called in. And it's been amazing how many people remember the Opry radio days.
Really?
And we're so into television, we forget, you know. But I was fortunate to have that exposure.
We just have a couple of minutes left. What do you think are some of the striking changes that have happened within the Grand Ole Opry?
Well, the country music scene has changed so drastically. We started out back at the Grand Ole Opry as a bunch of nice country people that were going around over the country, more or less like gypsies and troubadours, you know, putting on the play, putting on the shows in the small auditoriums. And then I think World War II had a lot to do with spreading this all over the world. And people became conscious of country music as an American way of expression. And folk music and country music sort of melded into, and then sort of a rock type has come in, what they call country rock has come in, and now country music has sort of spread around, and I wouldn't say dissipated, but flavored a lot of other different types, and then been flavored by a whole lot of different types. And the people who work in country music now are not the same type people, a lot of them. They started out being all country background people. And now a lot of the people are not exactly from the country, and yet they love country music, and they love to play it, and they love to sing it. So we have gotten us to be a sort of a melting pot. We have a lot of different types of people. And there are people now who live in elegant homes, some of them, and they travel by jet, and they travel in limousines, something we never knew anything about back in the old days when I was beginning in country music. And used to, people would ask me for an autograph, and they'd say, it's for an old aunt of mine in Montgomery. They were almost ashamed to admit the fact that they love country music. This is really true. And now everybody that likes country music says, I love it. And, you know, and it is the surveys that the people like, well, our Country Music Association in Nashville has taken some very interesting surveys, and we're accepted everywhere, you know. You never know where somebody's going to come up. I have people come up to me, executives and society matrons and all sorts of different people, and they say, I love that country music. Of course, it's informal, and it's most of it you can pat your foot to, or it tells a story of some story back in somebody's life they can relate to.
I wonder if you think that there's any connection between what's happening politically and what's happening in country music. Now, for instance, when President Carter was first running for the presidency, he surrounded himself at times with country musicians and would have them perform. It's always interesting to watch the musical choices that presidential hopefuls have. But I wonder if any of that affects you and the people who you know who perform.
Well, it does. And I must say that President Carter has done a great deal for country music because he had the country music artists into the White House, and he had programs in Washington where he went as part of the country music audience. And we appreciate that, and it's going to be very interesting to see how President Reagan reacts to this. I'm not at all sure that he cares for country music, but then I don't know. I haven't anything to go by yet. He hasn't come in, and I don't know what he's going to do. But if a president, now I'm going to make a wide statement, and I may be called down for this, your listeners may say that I'm mistaken on this, but in my estimation, if a president was smart, he would recognize country music. That doesn't mean he has to be chummy and pal around with all of them or have them into the more private recesses of the White House, but I think he should, if he is smart, a president, not just Reagan, any president, should recognize the importance of the country music vote.
Right. Well, if Reagan didn't like country music, what would it mean to the country music community?
Well, it would be a blow, but we would survive, having survived all these years.
Oh, it's really been fun to talk to you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's wonderful to be with you and to say to my Philadelphia and surrounding areas, howdy. I'm just so proud to be here.
My guest has been Minnie Pearl, and her new book is called Minnie Pearl, An Autobiography, and it's just been published by Simon & Schuster. It's 23 minutes after 3 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. In just a few minutes on Fresh Air, my guest will be Marilyn Bedell, who has just written a biography of Louisa May Alcott and the Alcott family. Thank you. A mandolin recording of Hoagy Carmichael's Stardust. Our mandolinist was Dave Apollon, who has a new reissue on the Yazoo record label called Mandolin Virtuoso. 4:26 is the time, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Everyone who has read Louisa May Alcott's classic Little Women has wondered how the March family of the novel compared to the Alcott family. Madeline Bedell, who's interested in fiction written by and about women, has completed the first book in a 2-volume biography of the Alcott family. In discussing the family, her book deals also with the social reform movements of the late 19th century in New England, including feminism, utopian socialism, progressive education, and transcendentalism. Author Marilyn Bedell is my guest, and her new book is called The Alcotts, a biography of a family. It's published by Clarkson Potter. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Tell us why you were interested in the Alcott family.
Well, I really think it was because of a childhood passion for Little Women. I think there's always some one book that really grabs us when we are our children, and with me it was Little Women. There were others. There was David Copperfield and Jane Austen. But it was that book, and it remained with me all my life. I think it's because of these are four archetypes of women, and so that we can identify with one or the other of them. And then also there is the fact that the family life in it, there is something so entrancing about it. In my book, The Alcotts, I call it a charmed circle. And I want to know what that charmed circle was like. I had heard a little bit about the Alcotts. I, of course, knew that Louisa May Alcott was the model for Joe, that the author was Joe March. I think anybody who has read that realizes that the author is Joe, because Louisa May Alcott was a very autobiographical writer, more so than most. And I knew that the father was a famous philosopher and educator, and I found out that he was a half-mad genius. I didn't know much about the mother. But I knew that the family was, I don't know, there's something about it. It's a very American family, something that even though we don't know anything about it, we feel we can relate to it. And that's what started me on it. Families have always interested me anyway.
This sounds like a pretty special family, a pretty radical family in a lot of ways. So I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the movements they were involved in that also tell the story of the time that they lived in New England. Now, I know that the period that you're writing about, the period that of the Alcott family, there was a movement of communalism.
Yes, that was just one of the many movements. This period in this book is what we call the antebellum period, which is before the Civil War, and then after the Civil War is called the postbellum period. But to me, it's a fascinating period because it is the period when our national identity was being formed and when a national ideology, and this is the liberal ideology, I believe, and it was these Alcotts who, along with others, Emerson, Thoreau, all these people, were at the heart, at the very root of this national ideology and of these movements. Now, one of the movements was, well, it wasn't communalism, it was communism, but it was communism with a small c, and it was utopian communism or utopian socialism. And the Alcotts founded Bronson Alcott, Louisa's fantastic father, founded a socialist, utopian socialist commune, along with a most mysterious and malevolent but fascinating English follower named Charles Lane. And their commune was called Fruitlands. It was in Harvard, Massachusetts. The four little women lived there, along with their mother and father, and a a motley crew of, if you think that there were eccentrics and hippies and so forth in the 1960s and 1970s, believe me, they paled beside the people at Fruitlands. There was an atomist. His name was Samuel Bowers. An atomist means a nudist. The people at Fruitlands made him wear a sheet around him when he went out, and there were the wildest kind of vegetarians. This was one of, I think there was something about at least 150 utopian communes in the United States at that time, and very few of them have lasted. The only ones that have lasted, to my knowledge, are those that were religious. The Shakers have continued, and there's some out west that were religious. But they fell apart. They all fell apart, but none fell apart more dramatically than Fruitlands, Bronson Alcott's Fruitlands.
What was the nature of the falling apart?
Well, it was a battle of a triangle of passions. It was a three-way battle between Abby Alcott, Louisa May's marvelous, independent, fierce, feminist mother, and Charles Lane for the soul of Bronson Alcott. And I can't tell you all of the details, but this battle between these three people went on in the dead of winter at about, that's why I say none fell apart more dramatically than Fruitlands, at about 20 degrees below zero with not much to eat and no fuel left. And this was the crisis in the Alcott family lives. And after that, it's very interesting, Bronson Alcott stated that you had to change society by being in society. You couldn't change it by withdrawing from society. And isn't this the same kind of philosophical struggle and things that people are questioning today, whether to withdraw from society or to get right in there and fight it out?
Since you've already made the comparison, let me continue at a moment. Some of the communes of the late 60s and early 70s were very involved with trying to redefine the family structure and broaden it so that family included friends as well as relatives, and that there was a more communal way of bringing up the children and of relating to one another, and sometimes that applied to sexual relationships as well. Was the family broadened in that regard?
Yes, they called it the consociate family was the marvelous name that the Alcotts used, and that stood for everybody in the commune. There were, I think there were about 12 people at one time in this too small place. I've sometimes visited it often, and I've often asked myself, just where did everybody sleep? There were very few women in this commune. In fact, at one time, the only adult woman in this commune was Abby May Alcott, and she had to do all the work. And believe me, that was one of the things that this commune fell apart on. You know, I have heard people who studied communes today, and they said that they have found none today where the work is not divided to some extent, at least, along man's work and woman's work. I think we all know that commune, successful agriculturally, at least out in Tennessee, called the farm. But that one, certainly, the women do all the housework. Well, in this one, the women did all the housework, but just remember I said there was one woman and her four little daughters. So in my book, The Alcotts, I have really tried to examine what were the dynamics that made this fall apart. And this certainly was one of them, was the burden that was put upon women in this commune, and particularly on this on Abby Alcott in this commune, because as Louisa wrote a wonderful, wonderful essay about it. It's available. It can be, I think it's in print today, and it's called Transcendental Wild Oats, and it is a howling satire of this commune.
One of the questions everybody wanted answered, particularly 10 years ago when there were a lot of people living in communes, is how are the children going to grow up, and how is this experience going to affect them, and what they want from their own family, and what kind of personality they develop. What was the answer to that in Louisa May Alcott's
first case? This was very short-lived. This only lasted 9 months. It didn't even last a year. So as far as the type of life they led, it did not, I don't think it affected them. We can't draw conclusions from that. Besides, they were supposed to be communally raised. The big problem in Fruitlands was the battle between the individual Alcott family, headed by Well, ostensibly headed by Bronson Alcott, but really headed by Abby Alcott, the interests of that family versus the interests, the philosophical, let us say, interests of Charles Lane and Bronson Alcott. And when the Alcotts finally broke up, Charles Lane was always accusing Abby Alcott of being too interested in her own family. And he said she has not yet that spiritual attitude, you know, which would allow her to be interested in the wider family. Well, of course, she wasn't. She was a very practical, very shrewd, and very intelligent person. The little girls really, they were given lessons, the poor things in a way, as Louisa said, the poor things, because they were given lessons both by their extremely vocal, rhetorical father and Charles Lane, who did Bronson Alcott bettered Bronson Alcott at being Bronson Alcott. And Louisa has a wonderful thing as saying, after learning all these lessons and then after discussing philosophical things such as what makes a man and so forth, and so she wrote down and said, and so to bed very tired. So the little girls did not like the communal upbringing. They were very, very happy when it broke up.
Okay. Now, so what was the marital relationship like between Bronson and Abby? You've hinted at that a little bit. Oh, yeah. I guess she did most of the housework and child rearing.
Well, no, that isn't really true. There are different phases. There are different phases in the Alcott marriage. That's why it's kind of a classical, universal marriage, and you can study it at this point, and then you can study it in their middle age, and then you can study it when she was doing all the work and he was off philosophizing, and then lo and behold, there's another point where he's doing all the work, and there's a point where she's out working. So anybody who said, when you say, what was the marriage like? The marriage was just like all marriages, all put together into one. And there was a time at the very beginning when he was really America's first child psychologist. He hasn't been given credit for this. When he decided that he was going to do record the lives of his first two children. It was Louisa and Anna, and this is Bronson Alcott. And he would produce the first history of a human infant. And then they would carry it on, and thus we would have the first history of a human being, and this came true. But in order for him to do this, he took over power. There's a chapter I have called Power Struggle in the Nursery. And he took over power, and he raised the children, and sometimes just recorded, and other times manipulated them. He used behaviorist techniques, which were striking in their modernity, and not wholly admirable, I don't think. He was very manipulative. He was an extraordinary man. So the marriage was stormy. It was loving. It was hating. I think it was a marvelous marriage when all is said and done.
You've called Abby Alcott, the mother in the family, a feminist.
Oh, yes.
What were some of her feminist activities?
Well, at one point, she had been an upper-class girl, and she really didn't have any skills, but the family was so poor that she finally went out and got a job. Very unusual for a woman of her age and her time, and a non-professional job. And she was hired as a visiting missionary to the poor by the Ladies Friendly Society of the South Congregational Church. Well, I don't think they quite, and they paid her. She was really Boston's first professional woman social worker. I don't think they knew what they were getting in for, because she just ate this up. It was as if she had been waiting all of her life for something like this. She happened to get the job in the middle of the most convulsive period in Boston and in other cities too, which was at the height of the Industrial Revolution and the beginning of the Industrial Revolution and the wave of immigration into Boston. And she wasn't content with going around giving baskets to the poor. Oh, no. She wanted to analyze the causes of poverty, and she produced brilliant reports, brilliant, on the causes of poverty, which she said, well, that's why they didn't like her. She said it was due to the cruel tyranny of the capitalist beast. But you see, this turned her into a feminist, really. She had been a sort of a feminist, but she was working mostly with women, and she saw these Irish women, how badly they were treated, how badly they were paid, how overworked they were, how they were exploited. Many of them, the young girls, were literally grabbed by so-called employment agencies and brought to houses of prostitution. And this made her into both a social and political radical and a feminist at the same time. And she then joined the feminist movement. There was a very strong early feminist movement, the roots from which we all come. All the women's movements were at that time. 1848 was the year, Seneca Falls. And she headed up a petition for woman suffrage, which she presented before the Massachusetts States Convention, and was very active in the movement. And, of course, her daughter followed her.
Louisa May Alcott, would you call her a feminist? Let me think back a minute to Little Women. I'm trying to...
Yeah.
I read it a long time ago. But I'm trying to think of the activism of her mother and the early domineering character of her father, mm-hmm. are portrayed like you're describing them in the novel Little Women. Mm-hmm. I don't recall it.
No, they're not. No, they're not. They're the mother and father. Well, the father's hardly in the novel. I mean, just forget the Reverend March. He's nice, but he's not Bronson Alcott. And the mother is Marmee, who is, no, she's not a social activist, although she's going to a job, but that's very, you don't understand exactly what it is. She's more of a symbol in Little Women, but she is a symbol, a matriarchal symbol. She's not socially active, that's true. But she is a powerful, she is the first and one of the few female authoritarian figures. This is domestic feminism, personal feminism, that is apparent in that book. Louisa herself was, I think that's why this book is such a classic and why we find it so intriguing to us, because she was a public feminist, Louisa. She also headed up the next battle for woman suffrage, and she was a contributor to the Woman's Journal, the leading feminist journal of the time. And she was also, from the time she was a girl, she was active in the woman's movement. But personally, she was always torn between the ideas of femininity and womanhood, and you're supposed to be domestic, you know, we all know those, and the family and wanting a husband and being sweet and feminine, and the other, the raging, independent, would-be writer, the rebel. And, of course, the four girls in Little Women, as were the four Alcott sisters, personify this struggle. And for me, I find this book, it's not rhetorical, Little Women, about feminism. What it does is it makes women and women's struggles important. And that's what I think is important. And that's what the Alcotts were, too. They're a very female family.
For a writer as biographical as Louisa May Alcott was, why do you think she gave the father in the family such a small role, considering that in her own life she had a much
He was all-powerful and all-encompassing. I think that's the reason she did. In the Alcott family, in the Alcotts, he was always a powerful figure, although his wife gradually wrested the power from him. But nevertheless, he was a dominating and powerful person in his children's lives. I think she took him out of the book precisely for that reason. Little Women it can be viewed on many, many levels, and one of the ways that modern critics are beginning to look at it is to call it a lesbian novel. Now, not lesbian in the sexual sense, but lesbian in the social sense, that it is an all-female family, that it is the female relationships that count, and that it is this bonding of sisters that with a matriarch at the head of it. Now, in order to do that, she had to push the father out, and by pushing the father out, she eliminated the strife, the struggle, the riveting sexual tensions that characterized the Alcott family and that characterized not only the father's relationship with the mother, but Louisa Alcott's own relationship with her father, Bronson Alcott, in which she was always...